And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. And with me is Phil Conlon. How are you doing, Phil?
Yes, good afternoon, Phil.
And today we're very, very pleased. We're going to be speaking to Robert Mirapol. He is the founder of the Rosenberg Fund for Children. And he is the founder of that. And he, together with his brother Michael, is the author of a book recommended by Carol Oates in the following words. Everyone should read this book. It's titled We Are Your Sons, The Legacy of Ethel and Julius Rosenberg. He wrote that with his brother Michael Mirapol. And later in the show, at about 5:30, we will be talking to Stephen Gowans about the latest book he has read about the attempt to reassess the Soviet history, you might say post-World War II history of those countries in Eastern Europe. It's going to be a fascinating interview, I guarantee you that. I may as well say right at the top, Phil, we've lost a dear friend, Patricia San Vicente, and
yes.
She died of cancer recently, much too young, at the age, I think, of 42, but he was a splendid individual. She's a friend of this program, and we are very sorry for that loss to the family of San Vicente. People will know her uncle, Miguel San Vicente, at a different book list. And you might drop by there if you knew Patricia and express your condolences. By way of preparation here, I'll just tell you, Robert Mirapol has a site. It's called robertmirapol.com/blog, where you can find his comments on this latest news. And there is also a site, the Rosenberg Fund for Children, and it is you can find it at rfc.org. And at that site, you will find a press statement by Robert Mirapol helping us analyze the significance of this most recent news. And I'll tell you what, I think we're reaching Robert now, but I'm going to just open this. I'll wait for Robert. I think we're joined now by Mr. Robert Mirapol. Are you there, sir?
Yes, I'm here.
Well, we are very glad that you're available to us. We have this important story. Many people, of course, are trying to sort out all these names and all these events. Let me just begin by the July 16th Toronto Star citing Eric Tucker of the Associated Press, and the headline is Testimony in Cold War Atomic Spying Case Unsealed. New revelation suggests couple may have been wrongly convicted, executed. And the first paragraph reads, Washington, the brother of Ethel Rosenberg, who was a star witness against his sister and brother-in-law in a sensational Cold War atomic spying case, minimized his dealings with his sister during an earlier appearance before a grand jury and said that they had never discussed her role at all, according to U.S. court records unsealed Wednesday. Now, you are Robert Mirapol. You're one of the sons of Ethel and Julius Rosenberg. You have fought as hard as anybody to see this testimony, of course, of all those who testified before the grand jury, but particularly this individual, your uncle, David Greenglass. What is your assessment, hearing that Associated Press account? What do you make of that?
Well, first of all, I agree with you. It is hard to sort of sort out all the different pieces and try to make it clear. As a good starting point, when you talked about me and my brother fighting for the release of this material, from the very beginning, now my name is Mirapol because I was adopted by Abel and Ann Mirapol, but I was born Robert Rosenberg, so the Rosenbergs were my and my older brother's parents. From the very beginning, starting in the mid-1970s, we filed a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit to try to get the material, the secret material in my parents' case, released to the public. And we have fought for that in one form or another consistently for decades. And this is why. you know, first of all, to explain, I don't know in Canada how well the legal system translates, but the grand jury where David Greenglass, the chief prosecution witness, testified to, that's what the prosecution uses in order to make a charge, make an indictment. Mm-hmm. And the testimony is given under oath, so it's sworn. So since it's sworn testimony, it's not supposed to be contradicted at trial, because that means either at trial or before the grand jury under oath, someone lied. Mm-hmm. And that's what happened in this case. That's the core of this. At trial, David and Ruth Greenglass both said that they met with my parents at their house in September of 1945 and transmitted the secret of the atomic bomb to my parents, and that David, it was a sketch of a cross-section of the bomb, and David had some handwritten notes that accompanied the sketch, and he testified that my mother, Ethel, typed up his notes. And that was the evidence that was used against my mother. Shocking as that is, because even if she did it, she would have been executed for typing. But instead, David Greenglass at the grand jury said, no, Ethel wasn't involved. So this, and so what do I make of this? Well, that's an important revelation, but it's made even more important because all our work to force the previously secret internal files into the public has given us a roadmap, not only to tell us that, yes, that's what David Greenglass was saying all along until just before the trial, when the government said we need to get more evidence against Ethel Rosenberg, and then he and his wife made up new stories. Mm-hmm. So, you know, so that, what he said confirmed what we already knew, but he said it in a manner and in a place that was impossible for the media to ignore, and now all of a sudden everybody's re-looking at my mother's guilt. But there's also something else which I hope we get to, and that has to do with my father as well.
Yes. Well, you know, I suppose many people, as you say, grand juries are odd creatures. We don't see them a lot in history, when they're mentioned, it really has a gravitas to it. Why, I guess anybody would say, well, why did the defense know about the grand jury testimony? Did they know, why couldn't they have their hands on that? It's sworn testimony. Why can't they have sworn testimony?
The rules have changed now. Back in the 1950s in the United States, the prosecution was under no obligation to give the defense grand jury testimony. So the defense never saw this. And you know, when you
this,
think about
I guess
about
the word
that,
would be abusive process. I mean, two people die. Two people die because we do not know that he had said something different.
Yeah, and that's you know, the prosecutors who, when they take their oath of office, have an obligation to serve justice. In other words, they're not just trying to win legal victories. If evidence emerges that shows that the people they're prosecuting are actually innocent, they're under an obligation to reveal that evidence. Well, clearly they didn't meet their obligation. And so that's what happened. Two people died. The other point I want to make about this is that it's not only that David Greenglass said Ethel wasn't involved. It's that both David and Ruth Greenglass, remember I talked about this meeting in September, which is the key meeting. Neither of them mentioned that meeting at the grand jury. And that's the story that, in the United States at least, the media hasn't really focused on. And that is that if that meeting didn't take place, then my parents had nothing to do with transmitting the secret of the atomic bomb. In fact, we're pretty sure that meeting never took place because the KGB files state that the material, the Greenglass sketch, was actually transmitted by Ruth Greenglass herself in December, not in September of that year. And so it looks like the Greenglasses were making up this September meeting to shift blame from themselves to my parents.
And they, of course, had a co-author here. By the way, thanks to you, I was able to read the testimony. I did read it last night. And one of the scary things about reading that sort of material is that you notice the prosecutor working on a narrative, and occasionally David Greenglass doesn't help him in the way that he wants help. He wants him to say, wanted your father to say, I'm going to give this to the Russians. Well, David seemed to be confused by that. He didn't remember that's part of the script, and he didn't go along so well with that.
That is true, though.
Do we know anything about how they worked on Ruth and David to get this done? Because that testimony wasn't that much in advance of their actual courtroom testimony, and their story wasn't together at that point.
Well, that's true. The story was not together. The courtroom testimony takes place in March of 51. This testimony takes place in August of 1950. And they were arrested in June, or David was arrested in June of 1950. I mean, basically, the deal was made that if David and Ruth Greenglass cooperate, Ruth would not be arrested and David would not be executed. So that we do have inside material of how they worked on David and Ruth. Mm-hmm. And that is that they brought them together and rehearsed them.
Yeah.
David was imprisoned, so it wasn't that easy at all times to do them. Sometimes they had to talk with them in sequence. But in the process of trying to put that together, they made some mistakes. And one key mistake that we uncovered in looking at David's testimony was we went and looked back at Ruth's testimony before the grand jury and discovered that she had said that no information was transmitted in the fall. And so the prosecutor must have gotten very upset about that, because when she testified that before the grand jury on August 3rd, the very next day he re-interviewed Greenglass in prison. And David then gave the statement about a transmission taking place in the fall. Nothing about a meeting at my parents' house, but a fall transmission. Then Greenglass actually contradicts his wife. David contradicts his wife 3 days later by swearing that there was a transmission in the fall. So you can see the way the prosecution is working to make a narrative, a clear picture.
Yes.
But the picture all evaporates when you look at the whole record. And for me, it's a combination of frustration and exhilaration.
Yeah. It has to be very painful, and for the rest of us, a very profound experience, because we're all learning. You and your brother and others have put yourselves through a lot of pain to get all this in front of people. This must be some satisfaction that one of the things that becomes evident is that they decided to target your mother when they had no basis to target her. But were they calculating that they could then create a new problem where they would try to get your father or your mother to cooperate more?
Well, yeah, I think that, in fact, there's an FBI file. It's astounding. It says, the evidence against Mrs. Rosenberg is weak, but we need to get a conviction and a stiff sentence so we can get her husband to disgorge. So, essentially, they picked up my mother and held her as a hostage.
That's a torture, yes.
Yeah, and put a gun to her head and said to my father, if you don't say what we want, we're going to pull the trigger. That's figuratively, not literally. And he refused, and she refused, and they carried out their threat and killed her, which is just what terrorists do. It was, you know, you could say this was a terrorist act on the part of the prosecutors.
This is because they anticipated further behavior of the same sort, where they wanted to send a message, right?
Yeah, they wanted to send a message.
And they wanted to send a message to America. The people are going to be killed.
That's right. It terrified people within the American left, because they said, it could happen to me, too. Now, Now, that said, I don't want to claim that my father was totally and completely innocent, because he was involved with a group of people to try to help the Soviet Union. He got started in World War II, but it wasn't atomic. It was military-industrial. It was stuff about airplanes and radios, and frankly, you know, you can do your own political analysis, but I think trying to help the Soviet Union defeat the Nazis during World War II wasn't a particularly bad thing to do.
Well, David Greenglass says that in his grand jury talk. He says, he makes you get the impression, actually the prosecutor regretted him saying it, but he said about 30% of the people were, you know, were Soviet supporters. And, and the prosecutor said, that many? because, well, actually, if you were to take a poll in America, the figure would be about 70-80%. I mean, we're forgetting what the situation was. The fight to the death against Nazism is kind of important.
Yes, that was true.
Something that would give anybody great qualms. You've been, of course, living through this, reflecting on it. I really appreciate your thoughts. I want you to tell... You remind people that they should stay clear of search for absolutes, and that's right. Could you talk about that a little bit, and your explanation of why you don't like the word closure?
Well, you know, first
I've given
of all,
you a long list, but go ahead.
Yes, you've given me a long list, but I mean, the fact of the matter is, if you look at my parents' case, there's some gray areas. My parents were not just innocent people who were picked up off the street randomly. They were active members of the Communist Party who believed in transforming society, making the world a better place. And yes, they didn't steal atomic secrets, but my father did what he could to help what he felt was the champion of the world's working class, that is the Soviet Union at the time, defeat the Nazis. And my mother was not actively involved, but she approved of it. And there are plenty of people in the United States who would say this is a terrible thing. And there are others who would say, well, wait a second, it's not that bad. But the point is, it's not a question of purity, that... The search for political purity is what I call political fundamentalism. It's the sort of secular version of religious fundamentalism. And what you find is we have to deal with nuance. We have to deal with subtlety. We have to understand that if the only people you're going to support are people who are perfect, you're going to end up supporting no one. So all of that is essential. And this idea that, you know, you come... Closure is often used in association with the death penalty, that if you end up, if a loved one of yours is murdered, you want the person who committed the murder to be executed so you can have closure. Well, I mean, that's absurd. Closure doesn't happen that way. People come to terms with their losses over time. And the fact that somebody gets executed very rarely makes any difference whatsoever in their ability to come to terms with that. It is an overused term that for instance, for me, and it's exhilarating to have this come out, but I can't say I've achieved closure because of it. It's what happened to my parents is a fact of my life. It's what I'm used to and I will live with all of my life. But the idea that somehow you put it all behind you, I think that's absurd. We all live with all of our experiences all the time.
And as you indicated, that the result of your work, we're still learning. More things are coming to light, and it helps us appreciate how to comprehend history. You can't have it like a children's book.
And you have to look at all of those little rules that the government is supposed to follow, that authoritarians are always telling us only help criminals. Well, here's one of those little rules about not allowing people to lie before grand juries and say different things at trial. Here's one of those little rules, and what it ended up helping the government of the United States do is execute two people for something they didn't do.
Yes, and create a terrible period, added to that period called McCarthyism, red baiting, mm-hmm. and nuclear arms races, etc. Well, I'm really glad, Robert Meeropol, that you founded the Rosenberg Fund for Children. Mm-hmm. It's a wonderful organization, rfc.org, and you wrote a more recent book, An Execution in the Family, One Son's Journey. And that's a great book, and now is the time for everybody to read it. Thank you very, very much, Robert Meeropol, for being our guest.
And thank you for having me.
Okie doke. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That's Robert Meeropol, and it's a compelling, important story about a moment in history that's going to go on down through time. So I urge you, by the way, thanks to the efforts of Robert Meeropol, his brother Michael, and others, we now can read all the grand jury testimony. And there are colorful people that you might have seen their names, and they're sitting there giving sworn testimony. People like Harry Gold talks. I'll tell you a little detail. My memory of reading Harry Gold's grand jury testimony, he said the Greenglass and Ruth seemed to be interested in money because he brought him some money. He was a courier. By the way, when he came, he didn't say, there's a famous quote, I come from Julius. In his grand jury testimony, when David Greenglass meets Harry Gold, there is no I come from. As a matter of fact, he said, are you David Greenglass? And that led to, if you want to really get into it, it's a very funny episode. Apparently, Greenglass panicked when he was asked that question. So Gold had to go away and come back and ask him again. But once they got acquainted, money changed hands as well, which I didn't want to go into with Robert today. I don't want to burden him. He gave us an awful lot of time, and there's so many details of this matter that need to be looked at. And since it is in today's headlines, this is, we're not talking 1950 now or 53 when they, Rosenbergs were executed at that wonderful monstrosity called Sing Sing. You could say Sing Sing and people's hair would stand on end. Phil, that's in your state, New York.
Yes, it is.
Nobody can pronounce the name of the place, so they call it Sing Sing.
I can pronounce it Ossining, and it was up the river. And it's a native name, by the way. It was a peaceful native community until they built their prison there and started killing people there. But it was up the river was the expression they used. They said, you know, they're going to send you up the river, and then, you know, and you weren't coming back.
Yeah. You could also, if we're talking about African-American history, be sold down the river.
Yeah.
And that was, they meant by that, you were headed south.
South. Deep, further down the Mississippi.
You're going to cotton country.
Yeah, yeah.
And that meant a different type of labor. Yeah. And you would die. It is very important to keep all these things in mind. And now that we've said the magic word there about these words in the South, I want to tell our listeners, I think everyone should go and find the New Republic article. Even the Wikipedia entry on To Kill a Mockingbird, or pardon me, Go Set a Watchman. I think a crime has been committed against literature, against culture, by greedy publishers. We're told that Harper Lee had a second novel. That is not true. She had one novel. It was called Go Set a Watchman. She gave that novel to an agent who gave it to Lippincott. Lippincott looked at it and said, well, we think you got a potential book here, but it's going to take work. So she and an outstanding editor at Lippincott worked for more than 2 years to bring that book into final, ready for publication. And they published it as To Kill a Mockingbird. The original title was Go Set a Watchman. And there's flax flying around dumping their things on us and with saying, oh, well, now this is a mature book. This is not for children. No, the first book was not published, not ready for publication. It was too confused. A collection of anecdotes, Lippincott said, and it needed work, and it got work. But they're trying to, obviously, to make a lot of money. And it's not pretty. And there's a three-part article. I don't know the author's name offhand, but you find it. Go Set a Watchman. Look at New Republic. There, he discusses the business decisions. The author, Harper Lee, is 89 years old. She's in a senior's home. She has a small circle of friends. Last November, she lost her sister, who was her sort of guardian angel, looked after things. And to go back, Lippincott used to come to the editor who had produced To Kill a Mockingbird with Harper Lee, and they said, has she got something else? Because they knew they had themselves a money-making item. And she said, I had to tell them no, because Harper Lee did not have another book and did not intend to write one. And she said, I had to fight them off because they would have published her laundry list. If you want to see an example of that, look at Jack Kerouac. You can find his laundry list because everybody's trying to make money off the name of Jack Kerouac. Everybody's got a piece of that. So the Circle, that editor died in 1974, Miss Hoff, I think her name was. Lippincott was sold to HarperCollins. And after the death of the sister, there was some people went to look into the vault, as it were. They had a meeting at a bank, which is, as the writer in the New Republic points out, that's appropriate. The publisher, the agent, all invest people really love literature. The agent and the publisher, and a lawyer always, discussed the finding a new book. Well, what they found was the book, as its original clumsy draft. In which many of the characters are repulsive and racist, and including Atticus Finch. Well, too bad for Atticus Finch. They decided to shred him and make some money. It's based on a real man, you know. Harper Lee's father was a lawyer. He had actually defended black accused. In To Kill a Mockingbird, correct me if I'm wrong, but the man is acquitted but killed by racist, I think, they say an attempt to escape, murdered. Now, the way they're selling this book is to say, well, you see, the Mockingbird's for kids. It's really, you think it's writing well for kids to tell them that he was acquitted? Pardon me, wait a minute, if I got this right, no, not acquitted, convicted. And it's in the Go Set a Watchman that he's acquitted. So the kid's book has him convicted. Doesn't seem like a very nice thing to, you know, put in front of a kid. And actually, the part of the story turning on the lawyer, Atticus Finch, is small in the original. It was the editor and Harper Lee working together decided to make that big and make something of it. All this is detailed. A number of writers have come forward, by the way, and said this is really bad stuff here. And I think people should be alerted to it. We don't need this talk about, one's for kids, the other's for adults. No, one's for business. One's for, you know, just flat business. And this is the problem of, you know, we have great names in literature like Joyce and others. And one of the side things that goes on that hardly anybody notices is the huge quarrels between families and corporations that own these things. And can, you know, so long as they're on everybody's reading list, you're going to be you're a made man, as they say. And so that it's not pretty. So we need to study that. Look at that. And I start with the New Republic. Three-part.
By the way, Phil, the author's name is William Giraldi. Giraldi in the New Republic.
And is himself a novelist, I believe. We're going to take, I think, a short break. Can we do that? We can continue. We're going to be speaking shortly with Stephen Gowans. And I think we have announced. What is that announcement, Phil? Have Thursday evening.
Thursday, July 23rd. And this is a gentleman who's a guest on the Taylor Report a few weeks ago, Joshua Tartakovsky. We'll be speaking on Donetsk in that part of Ukraine that is not under the control of the central government. He has visited that city, and he's going to report on it as a journalist. And that'll be at the different book list, July 23rd at 7 o'clock p.m., 746 Bathurst. And I just tell you, Joshua Tartakovsky is an American-Israeli independent journalist who writes about Palestine, Greece, and Ukraine.
Yeah. That's an important meeting. As you say, we did have him on this program. And this is, it's just like watching a volcanic activity. There's rumblings and reports of danger. And so we want to keep our eye on it.